the simplest way to differentiate shame and guilt, which is easily confused by people. Sometimes people will say they feel guilty when it's really more shame. Shame is, I am bad. And guilt is, I did something bad or something that I regret. I think the metaphor that I use for shame is the solar eclipse, where the soul or self is eclipsed. Mm-hmm. And it results in an urge to hide or withdraw or physically and emotionally shutting down. Guilt, by contrast, instead of a solar eclipse, I think of as a dark spot on the moon. So it is an aspect of the self, but it doesn't occlude or obscure the self. And it, the dark spot can be thought of as the thing we said or did that we regret that may have hurt someone we care about. And unlike shame, which invites us to withdraw or hide, guilt invites us to go toward the other and repair.
That's a great difference. When you say it invites us to go toward, it's not when we feel guilty, we don't always feel like going toward, but the opening is there.
The opening is there. Sometimes people say, I feel guilty, when they're actually in shame. And in that case, they don't have an urge to repair. They feel so bad about themselves and feel, in many ways, they feel like there's nothing they can do to redeem themselves. And so they rather than go toward, they hide. Uh-huh. You know, the expression hiding one's head in shame is both physically what we do, but also emotionally and in terms of our actions.
We all know that. I certainly know that place really well.
Right.
And then you also talk about pride and, you know, not the kind, I mean, I'm thinking it's not the kind of pride that's, like we're better than others. You're talking about something different, right?
Right. Well, pride gets a bad rap in our culture, probably in many cultures. And the pride that we often think of is what I call, and others call, hubristic pride, or like hubris. Or sometimes you can think of it as pathogenic or inauthentic pride. So there's different types of pride and different types of shame. So the type of pride that we're aiming for, I call genuine or authentic pride. So the pride that I think of when I think of contrasting it with shame is authentic pride. And that's taking pleasure or joy in oneself or one's accomplishments. Mm-hmm. And the if you look up the word origin of pride, it's kind of interesting, but if you take it all the way back, I think it goes to Old Latin, Middle or Old Latin. It has two parts to it. The first part is pro, like for, and it's P-R-O-B, pro, and then essa, E-S-S-E, or essence. So you can think of genuine pride as for one's essence or being. And but you can divide up shame and pride into what I think of as two types of shame and two types of pride. So we just kind of talk indirectly about two types of pride. The one is the hubris. That's the one that you were referring to. That's elevating oneself at the expense of others. It's the one-up position. It's often infused with anger, contempt, or disgust toward the other person. It's very non-relational. So using Martin Buber's sense of I-thou, this is I to it, not I to thou relationship. And it tends to be associated with kind of a hyper-arousal, kind of, you know, very high activation emotionally and physiologically. Whereas the self-righting shame, and I use that expression because it captures, the genuine pride is the pride I said before about, it's not puffed up at all. It's about sort of appreciating and valuing oneself, but not at the expense of anyone else. And interestingly, the chest tends to expand some in genuine pride, but it's not a forced puffing up of the chest. Just a natural easing and natural kind of expanding, kind of breathing more easily. And then in the two types of shame, one is the pathogenic or inauthentic shame, and the other is the self-righting shame. And the pathogenic shame is the shame most people know about. That's the shame that leaves us feeling debilitated, destroyed. It can be associated with self-loathing. It's often fueled by fear and self-directed anger or disgust. And there's a paradox about pathogenic shame because on the one hand, it results in our withdrawing and disconnecting, both disconnecting internally from aspects of ourselves that we're finding unacceptable, and then resulting in feeling we are unacceptable, but also disconnecting from others. The person in shame doesn't make eye contact, doesn't seek out others, avoids. But the paradox of pathogenic shame is that it arises in order to preserve a connection or an attachment to a cherished other. And that other could be a parent, a friend, a group, a society. So one way of thinking about it is there are two steps to create pathogenic or inauthentic shame. The first is you silence the true self, some aspect of the self that is who you truly are, in order to maintain some connection, again, with another person or a group. And then the second part is you would squelch any anger or protest against the shaming other. So it's an implicit agreement with the shaming other. It would be as if to say, in order to stay connected with you, I agree with you, I'm bad, I'm worthless, I'm deserving of being dismissed or rejected or ignored. So that's the paradox of shame, because it both keeps you connected to the shaming other and leaves you very disconnected from others. And just briefly, I wanted to mention that there's two types of, broadly speaking, two ways shame results, interpersonally, that is. Shame can occur sort of within oneself in lots of ways, but interpersonally, between yourself and someone else, it could be an active shaming, where that's the one most people know about, where someone calls someone else, you know, terrible, hurtful names. And then there's what I think of as a passive kind of shaming, which is actually more destructive in my mind, which is when someone fails to be responded to or recognized. It's like the child who comes up to the parent all excited to share something they drew at school today, and the parent ignores them or is kind of like has no real response. They don't say to the child, you know, leave me alone, you terrible, worthless so-and-so, but their non-responsiveness results in the child feeling ashamed, like there's something about them that makes them not worthy of the parent's attention.
This is great. This is so clear. Thank you, Ken.
Sure, you're welcome.
So how do we change this horrible dilemma?
Right. Well, it's a good question, because a lot of people feel, you know, when they're in the grips of shame, there's nothing you can do. But there's actually quite a lot one can do. I'll give you a few thoughts about how you transform pathogenic shame into what I call healthy or adaptive guilt. Remember, shame is the withdrawing, and guilt is the repairing. And interestingly, there's a whole bunch of research to show that psychopathology or emotional and psychological problems are not, as Freud had us believe, associated with guilt. Guilt does not result in psychopathology. Shame does. Very much so. So all sorts of psychopathology, depression, trauma, dissociation, social anxieties, you name it, can be thought of as having shame at its root. And if you think of it, shame is about the self, so why wouldn't it be showing up in lots of problems of the self and self in relation to others. But in terms of transforming it, here's just a few quickies, and then we can talk about some other methods of how to transform shame into healthy guilt. The one is you can encourage the person who's feeling in a state of shame to turn toward the other person that they feel they've hurt. Sometimes that seems like so simple, and it's not always easy to do, but sometimes you just say, look, if you hurt them, you can repair it with them. You don't have to withdraw. And that can sometimes really make a difference. The other kind of shift can happen when you do what I call an intra-relational repair followed by an inter-relational repair. The intra-relational repair can be thought of as basically bringing compassion toward yourself, like, I did that thing and I really regret it, but that doesn't make me a horrible human being. That would be bringing compassion and doing a repair within oneself. And then that prepares you then to go back to the person and saying, I'm really sorry about what happened, as opposed to, I'm a horrible human being and I know you don't want to have anything to do with me. Another form of transforming pathogenic shame into healthy guilt is can be thought of as dyadic regulation. And this is basically you get with someone who you know is accepting and caring toward you, and they kind of help you reconnect with your larger self as opposed to the shame self. Another thing that can help, interestingly, even though shame is such a powerful emotion that really just shuts us down, sometimes a more cognitive approach, what I call psychoeducation, can help. So just sometimes a person knowing the difference between shame and guilt, for example, can help them shift from one to the other. Not always, but sometimes. And then the last, which really kind of underlies everything when you're working with shame, is mindfulness. And mindfulness, I'm simply meaning here, I'm not saying you have to be doing mindful meditation, though that can help. I mean simply the ability to create some psychological distance or space between oneself and the experience or feeling of shame. So it's the capacity to observe that you're in a shamed state as opposed to that is some truth about me. And it also is a way to work with different aspects or parts of the self. So there's in shame, there's usually a part that is doing the shaming. You can think of it as the inner shamer or inner critic. And then there's the part that is being shamed. And mindfulness can be very helpful in bringing acceptance and even love to both aspects, both the inner shamer or inner critic and the part that's shamed, because they both are kind of serving some functions that need to be understood and helped with.
Wow, I'm sitting here, I'm taking all this in. Is there a little experience you could take us on?
Let's see. Yes.
Can maybe just talk about how somebody could do this on their own?
Uh-huh.
And I know there's.
Yes.
I know doing it with somebody else can help, whether it's a therapist or a good friend. But
right.
Maybe there's something we could do now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's, let's see, there's some approaches to working with the shaming beliefs that I can just name briefly.
Okay.
And then we could talk a little bit about working with parts, if you will, shaming parts, and maybe a little bit about what you can do physically.
Perfect.
So shaming beliefs, you can think of as the cognitive or thinking aspect of shame, because there are always beliefs, however primitive, about the self. You know, I'm terrible, I'm worthless, I'm not deserving of love. Those would be certain beliefs. Now, on the one hand, most people's view of that is, you know, I want to get rid of those beliefs. There's nothing good there. And on the one hand, of course, that's true, because it's very debilitating and destructive. However, if you can think of the beliefs as at least at one time in your life serving some purpose or function, then you might get at what that belief is trying to do for you, however much, it also hurts you. And one simple way to do it is to use a sentence completion, where you take the first part of the belief, something like, for example, I must believe I'm weak and incompetent, because if I didn't, then... And usually what that brings up is some aspect of the self that you're trying to shut off, shut down, deny, keep away, right? I must believe I'm weak, because if I didn't, I'd come across as aggressive. And I don't want to do that because I grew up with a parent that was violent. Now, then you begin to see how the belief serves a function, which is to try to do something differently than, for example, something the person experienced within their family. So that would be a simple way to get at trying to understand the function and utility, if you will, of the belief, even though it's obviously causing much harm.
That's great. Okay.
Another one would be, and this is working more with parts, is to see if you can contact. Sometimes you can do it through imagery, through imagination. Sometimes it's on a feeling level. But try to get a sense of what parts are doing the shaming and what parts are being shamed. So usually a person can hear the inner shamer. It's usually very harsh, very critical. There's certain words the person uses. I'm so stupid. That's the inner shamer, in effect, saying, you're so stupid. But it comes out as, I'm so stupid. Or, can't believe I did that. I'm such an idiot. Those kinds of things. So that is contacting the inner shamer. And one way to think about it is you can sort of say, let's imagine that that's not you, that's another person alongside you saying, thinking, feeling, doing those things toward you or toward an aspect of you. So that's contacting the inner shamer. The inner shamed part is the part that's on the receiving end of that. And you can also picture, if you will, or feel your way into that quote-unquote inner person or aspect of the self. And if you think about it as different parts, you're already beginning to take a step back and observing it. So that's a very important step already just by doing that. But you can also kind of get a sense of, well, why is the inner shamer doing that to this other aspect of the self? And there's some very common reasons. For example, often the inner shamer is, you know, if you ask the person, well, how old is that part of you, they'll say, sometimes it's like latency age, sometimes it's teenager. It's not usually much older than a teenager. And then if you ask them, well, what about the part that's being shamed, how old is that? They usually say younger, 3, 5. So it's like a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old getting on a 5-year-old. Not always, but something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think of it that way, you can get curious about, well, why would the 15-year-old be getting on the 5-year-old? Well, usually the 5-year-old is feeling something or doing something that was unacceptable at some point in that 5-year-old's life. For example, it wasn't okay to get angry, or it wasn't okay to express affection, or it wasn't okay to be vulnerable and have needs, or it wasn't okay to long for or seek connection. And so the inner shamer comes in to try to stop those feelings or expressions of those feelings to basically fit in with the group or the family or the parent or sibling or whoever it might be. And so if you can begin to see that, you can bring compassion first, and this is where you have to start, with the inner shamer. And that's the paradox. You go first toward the part that's being more critical. And you basically thank it for trying to help you, you know, when you were little, not express that anger that would have resulted in you being beat up, or to not express the longing when your parent was so depressed they weren't able to respond. So it would have been too painful to keep reaching out when you would have been not responded to. So you in effect thank the inner shamer for trying to help you in the old way, And then ask if it'll step aside and see if you, from, let's call it, a wise adult or more mindful, accepting place now, if you can attend to the younger part of you that was feeling, fill in the blank, sad, lonely, angry, hurting, etc. And sometimes, though that sounds kind of funny, once the inner shamer does not feel shamed him or herself, feels accepted by your, let's call it, your larger, wiser self, then the inner shamer is sometimes happy to leave and go do something else while you attend to the younger places that are feeling quite vulnerable.
It's wonderful. Okay. Wow.
I could give you some more on the thematic if that would be helpful. Or
yeah, that would be great. Yeah. No, let's do that.
So somatically or physically, what we all know, if we pay attention to what happens in our body when we experience shame, is there's usually a kind of two-phase process. Usually people are aware of only the second phase. The first is usually a kind of shock, startle, oh my gosh, uh-oh kind of response. I think of this as like Wile E. Coyote in the cartoons with Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, where Wile E. Coyote suddenly realizes he's run off a cliff. And that's the uh-oh, that's the shock. So usually there's a spike in arousal or energy first, often associated with fear, and then a huge drop. So there's like a sinking feeling. That's the feeling like I feel like I want to crawl into a hole. But that's also happening neurophysiologically. It's like Wile E. Coyote dropping. Down, 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 down. And then what people are often most aware of is then the hitting the ground, boom. That's the shutting down part. And that can be so painful, and you can experience so much repeated inner shaming, if you will, or external shaming, that the person can even dissociate, just kind of disconnect from their body. But if you think about the body in shame as more from that collapsed place or shutting down place, there's a whole host of things you can do. For example, often there's a collapse in the chest, and sometimes simply giving oneself some support in the back, like a pillow behind the back or a good supportive chair, and sitting up, because usually when you're in shame, the chest is collapsed in and the breathing is shallow. If you bring support to the back, your chest will naturally expand, you'll breathe more easily, and just that shift can resource the person, can help them feel not just that their breathing is better, but they can feel less shame. The other thing that can help that's more active is, since the energy is shutting down, you can do some things like you stand with your feet shoulder length apart, one in front of the other, bend slightly at the knees, and you push up from the ground up through your legs and through your chest and pushing against a wall. And you do that for like 10 seconds, and you switch one foot in front of the other. And that can help you reconnect with a sense of your own expansiveness and power within the upper body, which can also shift from the shame state into a more resource state.
Oh my God, this is fabulous. You should write a book around all this, Ken.
I'm hoping to someday do just that.
Okay.
That's the plan.
Oh, good. Good. This is incredible for all of us. So is there anything else before we end that you want to, like, gift us with?
Well, I guess one last thing is this. You know, when I do therapy with people, and I think this is really common, people who are in therapy, they think, well, I'm here to get rid of my problems, if you will. So as regards to shame, I'm here to get rid of my shame. I don't want to feel so much shame. And that's an appropriate goal for therapy or just life. But I think of it as the goal actually that goes beyond that. It's not just to eliminate or reduce shame. It's to restore genuine pride. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of ways to do that. But when you can connect more with a genuine sense of well-being and one's goodness, and basically a kind of valuing of oneself as opposed to a devaluing of oneself, then from a place of genuine pride, there's all sorts of things you can do, including going back to the other person who you felt shamed by and speaking with them, not from a place of reactivity or rage or hubris, but from a place of genuine pride, letting them know how whatever happened affected you and what you would hope you'd want different. And obviously, this is with someone that you think can receive that message. And if they can't, then you at least have restored your own sense of well-being within yourself.
This is fantastic. Oh, wow. I feel sort of dumbfounded. I have gotten so much. This is totally incredible. Totally incredible. Thank you so much for having done all this work, Ken, and bringing it to us. And for anyone who's a therapist or training to be a therapist and you're interested in more of this material on shame, pride, and psychotherapy, Ken has a forum by invitation that you're welcome to write him about if you are a therapist or a therapist in training and join the forum. And I'll put his email on the website so that you can have it. And love to have you sometime, Ken, come to the East Coast and maybe do a workshop, or maybe we can do something more with this, because I think it's so helpful, so wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you. I would be delighted to do that sometime. And I love visiting your area in Boston, because I went to school not far from there, so that would be great.
Good. We'll make a plan of that.
Okay,
all right,
cool.
Ken. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Deidre.